Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. The murder trial that began last week in South Carolina against the prominent attorney Alec Murdoch ranks among the most prominent examples of truth being stranger and scarier than fiction. John Grisham, on his best or worst day, could hardly imagine a more bizarre set of legal entanglements. Murdoch, who is 54, stands accused of murdering his wife and son in the summer of 2021. The trial is taking place in the rural part of South Carolina's Lowcountry, where the Murdoch family has reigned as de facto royalty for a century. And it's in a courtroom where Murdoch's grandfather's portrait hung up until the current trial began. But that's nowhere near the entire story. Insurance fraud, other suspicious deaths, a fatal boating accident that included the son who was later killed, stolen money in the millions, and a botched staged suicide. Plus, possible opioid addiction by the accused. All of these allegations, suspicions, and in some instances, confessions, have unspooled in the 18 months since the murders attracted national attention. The steady stream of sensational headlines has spawned a cottage industry of podcasts, documentaries, and national media attention. Today, we will look at the trial and the events surrounding it by hearing from three people who have reported on the Murdoch case from varying perspectives. They are James Lasden. He is a British novelist and poet who now lives in the U.S. and just wrote a lengthy overview of the Murdoch saga for The New Yorker. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jocelyn Greshick. She is a reporter at the Charleston Post and Courier, and she has been in the courtroom and around the courtroom in Walterboro. Good morning to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And finally, Bill Chappell is a writer, reporter, and editor for NPR's flagship digital news team. He, too, has covered aspects of the Murdoch case. Good morning, Bill.
Hi, good morning.
So we could discuss this for 6 hours, but we only have 1 hour today. So I'd like to begin with the same question for each of you. How much do you think the surrounding circumstances fueled these events? That is, a rural, high-poverty area where a handful of people hold a virtual monopoly on power and the justice system. James, I'll let you start. James, go ahead.
I think that was a big factor in the sort of presumption of impunity that Alex seems to have worked under in his insurance frauds. Excuse me. I think the isolation of the place, I mean, from what everyone when I visited was telling me is and you can see it for yourself, is quite extreme for these times. And I think there was a sense that they could just do these elaborate schemes of defrauding the clients they represented. This is Murdoch and his collaborators, and get away with it because they really were not being scrutinized in general. So I think that aspect of it, you know, was certainly impacted by the isolation of the place. Don't know about the murders.
Yeah, and I'll say too, I mean, this is a place where, you know, for hundreds of years, the wealthy have lived in a world apart. You know, this part of South Carolina, Colleton, gets its name from the family of sugar plantation owners who came from Barbados and helped found the Carolinas colony. I mean, this is like ingrained, kind of just a world of privilege and wealth has always lived in this kind of over a different realm above what's on the ground there. I mean, you see pictures from the Murdoch family's social media accounts and it's things from, you know, hunting and things. And then here they are in a private jet in New Jersey. You know, these are people who can project wealth and power in themselves well outside of that rural area. So it's an odd juxtaposition. Like James just said, it's when you drive, I grew up going through that area some, and when you drive through it, you wonder, you know, by the time you kind of figure out how the locals might pronounce that town name, you're out of that town. And it's just that kind of place where time doesn't seem to have existed. And I think it's been a place for hundreds and hundreds of years, the wealthy and privileged have lived a very different life from everyone else.
Jocelyn, you're based in Charleston, obviously. And before we came on, you were talking, you mentioned to me that it's about an hour southwest of Charleston is where all this took place. But for people who just go back and forth to Charleston or Hilton Head, give us some perspective on how remote this is.
Yeah, so I actually made the drive down from Charleston here to Walterboro just this morning, and it's pretty stark how quickly things kind of drop away as you're heading down Highway 17 out of Charleston and down towards Savannah. You pass through Walterboro and you kind of will veer off into it, and you're going down 17. And, you know, I had breakfast at Chick-fil-A this morning, and it's funny how quickly stuff like that just driving down and it'll just disappear. And yeah, I don't know. It's pretty remote. You'll drive through farmland and swampland. So yeah.
James, I mentioned in my introduction, John Grisham, if I can say his name correctly. And, but I could have mentioned you, because here's what you wrote in the New Yorker, quote, "Years ago, I wrote a novel in which the protagonist sets up a similar suicide disguised as murder scheme for an insurance payout. I'd worried at the time that this turn was a stretch, and it had nagged at me ever since. But here was real life vindication of my plotting, with the added twist that even the underlying suicide story appeared to be a fiction," end quote. With that in mind, if you could interview Alec Murdoch, what might you ask him?
Oh, God, where would I begin? I mean, and how would I know whether to believe a single word he told me? And that's part of the interest. I mean, you know, speaking in a sort of detached way, part of the interest of the case is you're on such sort of shaky ground at every juncture. You really don't know what to believe. It's just one series of fake outs after another. I mean, this seems to have been Alec's MO. I mean, he just was a manipulator, a deceiver, whether he was manipulating and deceiving his clients or manipulating and deceiving or attempting to the law enforcement after the murder of his wife and son, or on the roadside incident with where he was first of all claiming that he had been the victim of an attempted murder, and then when that story fell apart, he says he had tried to get his cousin to kill him in a sort of fake, in a sort of assisted suicide scheme. Personally, I don't think that's the end of it either. I mean, I know that's as far as law enforcement is concerned, they seem to have stuck with that story as the basic truth of what did happen on the roadside. I'm not at all convinced by that. I'm very curious to hear what the others on this panel have to say about it. But it's, yeah, I would ask him, I would try to pin him down on what really happened there to begin with, because I think that holds a lot of the key to a lot of it.
That's the voice of James Lasden. He has written about the Murdoch trial for The New Yorker. Also with us is Bill Chappell from NPR and Jocelyn Greshick from the Post and Courier in Charleston. Jocelyn, I'm curious, as I mentioned, you're in South Carolina every day. That's where you're based. Before these events occurred, what, if anything, did you know of the Murdoch family? Had you ever heard of them?
So I came to the paper and to South Carolina in August of 2021. So pretty much a month right before this Labor Day shooting that we were just talking about. And before that, no, I really hadn't. I mean, when I got there, Maggie and Paul had already been killed, because that happened in June of 2021. So already when I got to the paper and in the months kind of, and when I was in the interview process, I was, I think like a lot of us, reading about it, very enthralled. But I will say, kind of in doing that reading, I realized that I wouldn't say I have direct connections to the Murdochs, but I have friends of friends who went to school with them, and who I'm from Charlotte, actually. And so it kind of speaks to the small world that I think is some parts of the South. It's funny.
Bill, I'm curious, you did an extensive timeline. It may be helpful, as much as people are hearing these names and they know something really unusual has happened in this part of South Carolina, maybe just a quick synopsis of, you know, how did we get here?
Well, I mean, it's the interesting thing is, I mean, I think what James alluded to also, it's, you know, it's very tempting to tell this story in a linear way, but that also implies like a rationality is at work, you know, that things really did lead to one another. It's hard to know what came first and what caused something else. And I actually first heard of this family and this what became now seems to be this case in 2019. A friend of mine, I'm from Aiken, South Carolina originally, and a friend of mine who flits around the state and loves political scandals had posted on Facebook something about the locals in this area near Hilton Head being, and it's the Hilton Head Island Packet, I think is the paper he posted a story about from. Just the locals were up in arms because there was the young scion of a local, like powerful family had been involved in an accident and a young girl had died who was not as privileged, it seemed. And there was seemingly, you know, no accountability. And the authorities were really taking such a long time. People were getting incredibly frustrated, and that like that there was a just it was quite a frenzy on their Facebook postings about it. And so I sort of I started digging in a little bit, and so I really have been stunned and staggered to see where this went because like I think a lot of people you kind of understand something as it comes to you. So when this boating accident happened in 2019, Paul Murdoch and his friends had been drinking and partying for quite a while in February of 2019. And they eventually went to an oyster roast that was actually, strangely, that's oyster roasts are fantastic parties. This one was dry because it was given by a school principal. So they had a boat that they took to the party, and there was a cooler full of more drinks there. I think Paul and another guy who was on the boat were then seen. There's a day landing dock down at Buford's downtown where they pulled up and hit a place. There's from what the videos say and what local reports said, they had a lemon drop and a Jaeger shot inside of maybe 15 minutes and then got back in. And then later there was a horrible accident with the boat where Paul, who, as James pointed out in his fantastic article, and that kind of lays all this out in the New Yorker, that, you know, he's known to kind of transform into a different kind of person under the influence is what people said. So belligerent and maybe arrogant about his ability to drive despite being impaired, the boat has an accident and Mallory Beach is thrown out along with I think her boyfriend and Paul himself. And everyone gets out except for Mallory, and the kids all wind up at the hospital. They call 911 and everything after looking for Mallory. And then at the hospital, Paul's father appears and goes around talking to all the kids, telling them not necessarily, might be too much to say get their story straight, mainly just not to say much at all to anyone, that he'll handle things. So this kind of like this event is also then what later what Alex Murdoch like really immediately started talking about when he was reporting an emergency at his house at the Moselle Hunting Estate, where his wife and younger son have both been shot. So, you know, we say this is a long story and it starts with this boating accident, and you don't know whether to trust that. I just kind of say that in parentheses as I get into that. And along every step of the way, every big event that's notable seems to also have a revelation of another financial misdeed comes out around that same time. So it's very tempting to connect those things and think that they're logically connected.
Let's hold that thought. We have
about.
No, we have a lot more to get to. Stay with us. Much more on Alex Murdoch and the trial going on in South Carolina that's captured the nation's attention. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation about the murder trial of Alex Murdoch in South Carolina, a case that includes many subplots and bizarre twists. My guests are James Lasden, who has written about the case for The New Yorker, Jocelyn Greshick, who is a reporter at the Post and Courier in Charleston, and NPR digital news editor and reporter Bill Chappell. Now, Jocelyn, Bill took us up to roughly June of 2021. You arrive at the Post and Courier, I think, in August. And then what happens in September of 2021?
So in September, Labor Day weekend, I remember exactly where I was watching news reports come in about Alec Murdoch, the patriarch of this legal family. He had been shot in his head on the roadside, I believe, of Savannah Highway on his way from Hampton, where he lives, to Charleston. And that was kind of all we knew at first, was just this reporting that he'd been shot in the head. And that sounded like a pretty terrifying injury. We knew that he had been airlifted to a hospital. There's some back and forth about whether it was the Charleston hospital or Savannah, but I think pretty quickly we knew that he had survived, that he was talking to his lawyer, Jim Griffin, that he seemed to be in, you know, okay health. And the initial reports was that it was a totally random side of the road drive-by shooting as he was changing his tire. And then as things kind of evolved from there, I mean, it was a matter of days, it felt like. And then we find out that this guy, Curtis Eddie Smith, who's distantly related to Murdoch, was involved. And I think the initial kind of scenario with that was Eddie had been hired to shoot Murdoch so that Murdoch could die and his life insurance policy could go to his remaining son, Buster Murdoch, in sort of an assisted suicide ploy. But if you ask Eddie, he'll say that, you know, there was this struggle over the gun and that he had no idea this is what Murdoch, you know, had called him to the side of the road for, and that if he wanted Murdoch dead, Murdoch would be dead. So
now, when that sequence of events that Jocelyn just described happened, that's when the national attention really went into overdrive. So before we delve further into the case, let's listen to an interview that our regular host, Mike Collins, did with Matt Harris. Matt Harris is the co-host of the Matt and Ramona show on Mix 107.9 in Charlotte. But since 2021, he has spent his spare time co-hosting a podcast dedicated to this case, and they've done 94 episodes to date. Here's what he had to say.
So the first question I have to ask you, Matt, is you do this commercial radio show, the Matt and Ramona show, every morning, 6 to 10. It's not news-based, but now you've done 92, maybe 93 episodes of this podcast covering the bizarre yet tragic story involving Alec Murdoch and his alleged murder of his wife and son, and there's so much more to this. So why? What piqued your curiosity to delve into something completely out of character for you?
Well, I've been a true crime fan of the genre for many, many years. In fact, my boss now was my boss back when I worked in Columbus when the OJ trial was going on, and he remembers how fascinated it was, and they flew me out for the verdict when that occurred. And that might have been the beginning of my fascination of watching trials and all the datelines out there and the podcasts. So I've been looking for a case to do for a podcast, and my co-host of the podcast, Seton Tucker's friends with my wife. They were out one night. Seton's telling her the story about the Murdochs and the murders that happened the night before. And she's like, I'd like to do a podcast, but I have no idea how to do that. And my wife's like, my husband's always been looking to do a true crime podcast. The next day, Seton and I had lunch, talked about it. And then a few days after that, started doing the podcast about this case. She started back when Mallory Beach was killed in a boating fatality accident, and Paul Murdoch was the alleged driver. And she just got sucked into it. She related to the Mallory Beach because she has a daughter that was about that age, and she grew up in the low country. And so I've been following it when the murders happened. So I just said, I'm not even going to research it. Let's go in tomorrow, do something. And then, dang, that thing just went nuts.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. First of all, the secret to your success is obviously finding the right woman to work with.
Because
Ramona on the radio and Seton right. Tucker on the podcast.
That's right.
But you just launched into this. How does a podcast go from zero? You just sit in the studio, you record it, you put it out there, ain't no listeners, to suddenly exploding into what it's become.
one of the big turning points in the Murdoch case was on Labor Day after the June murders. Alec was saying that he was shot in a drive-by. He started with that story, and then he said that he hired someone to kill him for insurance money, but we know that's not true. That really weird twist of this guy who was seen as this tragic figure has this weird thing out of character happen, and then that started the ball rolling, everybody finding out about the millions and millions of dollars that he had stolen. So I started popping up on, you know, shows like Nancy Grace and Court TV and various things like that. And out of nowhere, we went from, you know, a few thousand people listening to being in the top 50 of all podcasts within a couple of weeks after that incident.
You know, trials take a long time. I'm sure you knew that going into this, but did you have any idea that, because you started this in June of 2021, that you would still be doing it in January of 2023 and well beyond that? I'm sure you're going to continue this until it's over.
Right. We had no idea. We really, and unfortunately, if anyone starts at the beginning of our podcast, they'll be like, these guys are awful. They are terrible. How did they make it to 93? She had never been on the air doing anything ever before in her life. And true crime was new to me. And so we worked our way through it and trying to sort out what we can say, because we heard all kinds of rumors. We want to be careful in that. We want to have some journalistic integrity, or just integrity. And I wanted to provide some depth to each of the people involved in the cases, show empathy and sympathy and other sides, and try to be to weigh it both. So every week we go, okay, what are we going to talk about this week? What are we going to talk about? Then another thing would happen. He'd have another somebody come up with a lawsuit or missing money, or things would leak out about the murders. We did not have to struggle to come up with a weekly podcast. And then we started adding a bunch of experts in various fields to the podcast to add to it as well.
Your podcast is called The Murdoch Family Murders, Impact of Influence. And it's called that because he is from a highly influential family in South Carolina. So it's highly unusual for this kind of an incident to affect this kind of a family. But everything changed on June 7th, 2021, when Alec called 911.
Hampton County 911, what's your emergency?
This is Alec Murdoch at 2147 Moselle Road. I need the police to pass us immediately. My wife and child got badly.
I have an Alex Murdoch on the line. He's advising that his wife and child was shot.
Is he moving at all, your son? I know you said that she was shot, but what about your son?
Nobody. They're not. Neither one of them's moving. So please hurry.
Dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Is it acting?
I guess that remains to be seen. And I it always bothers me when there are, you'll be like, oh, he definitely was faking it, or he definitely wasn't faking it. Like, we know what someone would do in this situation. Or, you know, some podcasters or broadcasters will go, oh, and it was 2 days after her mother was murdered and she got a tattoo of an owl, so she's obviously a murderer. I don't know that anybody can expect there to be some sort of certain reaction when something happened. Even if someone had murdered, let's say he murdered them, who's to say he's not still upset? That was upset, but for a different reason, right? One of the moments in the trial was when recently when Alec was shedding tears when he was hearing about it, his son being shot. And people are like, oh, well, that, you know, he's faking it. And I'm like, he could be crying even if he did it. I don't think it proves one way or the other. When you played the 911 call, it reminds me of the fact when we started doing this, we were getting like 911 tapes and all the motions and all the things that were filed ahead of most people because of the connections we had made since doing this at the very beginning with people around and about that case. We weren't the only ones. There's a few people getting about the same time, but it's amazing how people rallied around our podcast to be helpful.
And you're not just sitting in the studio talking about this and reading news reports about this. You've actually gone to the trial. What are you gleaning from going there and being in the room that you couldn't glean just from watching reports on TV or reading about them in news articles?
Not really dodge the question, but just to expand on the question, is when we started doing the podcast, we went down there and got into the area and talked to locals And we've gone there, I don't know, maybe a half dozen times or more, and driven around to get the idea of where the Moselle property is, where the murders occurred, to where he drove to see his mother that night, if it pans out that that's what happened. You know, we drove that to see what it was like. We stood outside and we checked phone reception outside of Moselle. And there's two entrances to Moselle, which one was overgrown, which was not. We've been to the courthouse. So going into that area, I think it's been important to understand the people, the change in the people's reaction to the Murdochs. And in the trial, it's palpable, the energy, whether it be some people, the energy of like, oh, I want to burn that guy at the stake, or I can't believe this happened to this town that had to bring in food trucks because they don't have enough restaurants to support everybody, trying to work their way through this thing. And they've done a really amazing job. And also they worry about their reputation in that area of being just a bunch of rubes.
I believe that you were in the courtroom for some of the jury selection process. And whenever you select a jury, you ask them about their media consumption surrounding the trial at hand here and whether they've heard or seen or read coverage of it. I'm just curious, after 92 episodes, did your podcast come up? Had potential jurors listened to your podcast?
Well, the podcast was listed on the jury sheet that they fill out, which was kind of good, I guess. That's nice. When the judge asked them to stand up and ask what they've listened to or watched, at least in four pods, I think, four segments of jurors. So I didn't see them all. But the one I saw, they mainly just doing generically podcast TV. One guy says, I learned it all from my wife. And I got a little chuckle from the crowd.
You do this daily radio show with Ramona Holloway, Matt and Ramona. It's heard here locally on 107.9, but it's also syndicated. So you're already all over the country, and you've been on, as you said, because of this podcast, News Nation, Court TV, American Greed on CNBC. You got a shout out on Good Morning America on ABC. When this is all over, given the name you're making for yourself in this new genre, are you going to continue? Are you going to find another true crime to devote a podcast to, or is this out of your system now?
No, definitely not out of my system. I will say, though, as the trial cranks up, the lack of sleep, because as you know, getting up early in a morning show and doing court TV at 9 o'clock at night and then doing the podcast in between, that it pumps me up. And we are looking for another case. We have two that we've been kind of working on. This is a weird one for even a true crime podcast because it's happening in real time. Mostly the cases that you listen to podcasts, they happened, they already started, they already ended. We've been meandering through this. So if anybody knows a good true crime case they'd like us to take on, mattharrispodcast@gmail.com. We've talked to some local people in the area about potential cases.
The Murdoch Family Murders, Impact of Influence is the name of the podcast. Matt Harris, our guest, and Seton Tucker do the podcast, and you can pick it up wherever you get your podcast or listen to Matt and Ramona, as long as you turn it off at 9 to listen to us on 107.9. Thanks, Matt, for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it.
So that was Mike Collins with local radio host Matt Harris, who has started a true crime podcast focusing on the Murdoch trial. James, that makes me wonder, particularly in your case, I think people who have heard you speak might catch on to the fact that you're not from South or North Carolina, perhaps, maybe not even from America. So you obviously have moved to the U.S. from England. Tell me what motivated you to pursue this, because you're a novelist and a poet, as I mentioned earlier. So I don't think your main focus is typically true crime.
No, but I have written about crime before for the New Yorker and other places. But and it does interest me, and just on a basic human level. But I don't. It's hard to say exactly what drew me aside from just the story itself. I mean, I am interested in the South. I haven't spent much time there, and I was, you know, very conscious of my ignorance about the South, and I wanted to tread carefully because of that. But I also, you know, I journalistic sort of assignments like this are great opportunities for learning about things, and I wanted to know about the story, but I also wanted to know about the context. And I spent quite a lot of time just driving around with people who were not necessarily directly connected to the story and learning about the sort of historic and also the geographic sort of impacts on this story. Why was, I mean, does the mystery of Alec himself and what motivated him and what his weird pathology is or maybe, there's also the question of, well, how was he not stopped earlier on? Why were there no real sort of obstacles to his greed? And he was acting not alone. I mean, he was in these frauds. He was being helped by, you know, people in the banking community, people in the legal community. And I wanted to understand a little bit more of the broader context. And it was very interesting from that point of view.
Jocelyn, I want to ask you, because you are there and you're about to go report on what's going to happen in court today. What's your impression of the consensus, if there is any, in Walterboro, in Colleton County? What do people make of the spectacle that has arrived at their doorstep?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and one I wasn't quite sure what the answer would be until I got here last week, because we had done some pre-reporting about kind of how the town was preparing. And I feel like kind of half the town was very weary of turning this case into a spectacle and using it almost to their economical advantage in a tourism sense, because, you know, the tourism director was very aware that this was happening and going to bring like a big influx of people to this tiny, tiny town. And then, yeah, you had this other group of people that were excited to have to kind of take advantage of all these new faces coming in. And so I think it's still kind of a mixed opinion. You know, right outside where I'm sitting, there's about 8 food trucks there to feed us every day. And some people hate that. But also there are townspeople who are coming to get their lunch there because they think they're excited to have some new restaurants around to get their lunches from. But I've been personally really loving just being here in the town, and everyone's been so welcoming and hospitable and accommodating. And in terms of Walterboro handling this influx of media, it's all gone really smoothly, I think.
Well, thank you so much for taking time. We know you have a busy day. So Jocelyn Grushik with the Post and Courier, we'll let you go. And James and Bill, you have to stay with me. Apologies. And of course, everyone listening, you have to stay with us too. This is Charlotte Talks, more on the Murdoch trial coming right up on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guests today are 3 reporters who have covered various aspects of the murder charges and trial of Alec Murdoch in South Carolina. James Lasden is here with us from The New Yorker, Bill Chappell from NPR, and Jocelyn Grushik, who just left us to head back to the courtroom to figure out what's going to happen today. James, Bill, I want to go back to the national fascination with this case. Here is an interview with one of Alec Murdoch's attorneys, Dick Harpootlian. This is from NBC's Today Show, and co-host Craig Melvin will speak first. And this occurred in September of 2021, just after the failed suicide attempt by Alec Murdoch.
Dick, you've prosecuted serial killers, university presidents, you've represented some characters over the year. You have to admit, this is a pretty unbelievable story. Your client claiming that he paid someone to shoot him to collect $10 million in insurance money, and the guy missed? Is that the story?
Well, let me elaborate. On Monday, Jim Griffin and I, Alec's attorneys, traveled to an out-of-state detox facility where we actually had the first conversation we've ever had with him when he wasn't on opioids or oxy. And as a result of that, he clearly knew what he had done was wrong and explained to us a couple of things. One, the murder of his son and wife 90 days ago took a tremendous toll on him. His father died of cancer that same week. Most people couldn't get through that. He got through it with the use of opioids. And then last week, a week ago actually, it was uncovered that he had converted some client and law firm money to his own use. And again, spent most of that on opioids. And on that Saturday morning, he was trying to get off the opioids. He was not taking any of them, was in a massive depression, realized that things were going to get very, very, very bad, and he decided to end his life. He believed that $10 million policy had a suicide exclusion. Suicide exclusions are only good for 2 years, and he didn't realize that. So he arranged to have this guy shoot him.
Dick Harpootlian on the Today Show with Craig Melvin. I'm curious for both of you, when you hear that minute and a half roughly, what comes to mind? Because that is a head-spinning amount of detail, circumstances, bizarre occurrences. I'll let you fill in the rest.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been caught in the bottom of a big wave in the ocean where the water and the air just kind of suffuse each other and it becomes atomized and you don't know which way is up and which way is down. That's how a lot of this feels. I mean, there's so many striking details that you are tempted to grab onto and think, you know, this is the thing that explains all this. And then you realize this, you're constantly, you know, trying to grab something that's bigger than you thought it was 5 minutes ago.
James?
So
it is like that. But I mean, and there are these very strange things. I mean, you have this eminent attorney and legislator admitting his client committed a crime, which is unusual. The amounts of money involved in this thing and the idea that they all went on opioids or most of it went on opioids is sort of preposterous. But then where did it go? The question of the idea of this guy who's an insurance lawyer who allegedly, I mean, has been creating all these very elaborate schemes and scams, the idea that he wouldn't have known that there was no suicide exclusion policy on his own life insurance is, from everyone I've spoken to down there, that's something any second year law student would know. So a professional insurance lawyer is going to have known that. So what really was going on? Clearly it was not what he first said. It wasn't an attempted murder. It wasn't some sort of somebody trying to get revenge for the boat crash, taking a pot shot at the Murdochs. But was it really a suicide attempt? Was he really trying to kill himself, or was he trying to create the appearance that he had attempted to kill himself, which to me seems slightly more likely? The wound, he did have a wound at the back of his head, but it was very, very superficial. I think as Jocelyn said earlier, I mean, if Eddie had shot him from fairly close range, Eddie's an ex-military guy, seems unlikely he would have missed. It seems to me that somehow he wanted to create a very superficial wound on his head, and he did create that. Whether he had the help of Eddie in doing that or he did it himself, I don't think we'll ever necessarily know, but we do know that Eddie Smith took the gun and got rid of it, and it hasn't been found. I think it's been established as a fact. Bill, correct me if I'm wrong.
I think so.
So it's just very hard to read and to get to the bottom of this, but it's quite interesting to try.
Well, and James, I want to ask you, there's so many threads to this that we can't get to all of them, but one of them that I do want to get to is that clip was of Dick Harpootlian. He is a prominent, not only a prominent attorney, but he's a state senator in the legislature in South Carolina. He is so prominent within the Democratic Party that I believe his wife is an ambassador in the Biden administration.
To Slovenia. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. That's what I was trying to get out. And I think you spoke to him perhaps, James, but either way, give us a sense of Dick Harpootlian and how he figures into this.
I did speak to him, and he's considered one of the best sort of defense attorneys down there. And he's also this very powerful legislator. And in South Carolina, the legislators choose the judges, which is unusual for this. I think there's one of only two states where judges are elected by the state legislature rather than voted by the public, which means that the judges have a kind of relationship with because some of these legislators act as attorneys then in front of these judges, the judges have a relationship with them, which is, at least by appearances, doesn't look particularly great. And it's not a question of necessarily of corruption. It's just, I think particularly with the boat crash, when Harputlian was representing Paul, I think there was a sense then that, you know, he could get Paul off. I mean, there were, not necessarily because the judges would be corrupt or anything like that, but there were uncertainties in the testimony. There was a little bit of sort of uncertainty around who was actually driving the boat. Not very much. It almost certainly was Paul, but there were little changes of testimony here and there. And I think there was a feeling that a good, powerful attorney might be able to get Paul off. And they got the best and the most powerful. So I think that played into this later idea, whether it was a concoction or was real, that somebody was trying to get preemptive justice for the boat crash, and that somebody might have killed Maggie and Paul. And this was the story that Alec Murdoch himself took up and tried to purvey, whether truthfully or as a fabrication. We will find out from the trial.
That's the voice of James Lasden. He is a reporter for The New Yorker, among other things. He's also a novelist and a poet. Jocelyn Greshick with the Post and Courier was with us earlier. She has now gone to the courtroom proceedings in the Murdoch trial. And Bill Chappell with NPR is also with us. Bill, you mentioned earlier that you're from Aiken originally. And I'm curious, you know, whenever something happens in your home state, for all of us, the instant question from everyone you know is, hey, what's going on down there? What's in the water? Why is this happening? And I'm just curious, how do you try to explain this, or do you even make the attempt?
Well, you know, I think, it is occasionally, when you hear your home referenced in headlines, you sort of cross your fingers as you read the rest of the headlines sometimes. A lot has been made of that this is a small town, and that's certainly where the true in Walterboro, where this trial is happening. But also, you know, the Murdoch family controlled the solicitor's office in the 14th district in South Carolina for, I think, 86 years since it was founded. And it's unusual that circuit is actually the only one in the state with five counties. It's like roughly, South Carolina has 46 counties total. And by land, I think it's a little over 10% of the whole state. So, you know, this is not like a tiny fiefdom that generated an inordinate amount of wealth. I mean, this is a family that had its tentacles of power spreading, to put it in a dramatic way, for decades and decades, because as they became integral to that solicitor's office, they also founded their family law firm. And, it includes little small towns. It also includes Beaufort, which is a historic city and town along the water, which is booming. Like Fripp Island is down there, great resort areas that people might know well. So, it's not as like a case of a weird podunk town with one rich family or something. I think it's a little bigger than that. So when I try to give people some context, that's some of what I tell people is that, I have some relatives who live there. We used to go down there every year for oyster roast, and it's a great place to have fun. It's also sometimes, as a young person, it's the kind of place where sometimes young people might find the only thing fun they know how to do there is to drink and party. It's hard to kind of to focus yourself is what I found from being around there.
Fripp Island also.
In terms of the case itself, it's been, just. I lay all that down as context. In terms of understanding it, I'm so curious to see how the prosecution is going to present this in a way that a jury can understand and present like a credible verdict that can't be picked apart somehow by the defense, which, as we said, is led by a really imposing team. I lived in Columbia for a while, and Dick Harputlian ran for attorney general of the state back then. So, you know, his name has been around for decades as someone who is incredibly competent and capable. So that compared with the local kind of the home team flavor you get from the Murdoch family, it's I'm very, very curious to see what happens next.
I was going to you mentioned Fripp Island. That, of course, was a longtime home of the novelist Pat Conroy, who tried to explain South Carolina to millions of readers for many decades. James, I was going to ask you, you know, we haven't even gotten into the now, I guess, re-examined deaths of a young man near Murdoch property in 2015. There was the death of, I believe, a housekeeper on the property in 2018, and allegations that life insurance money was stolen after she died. So what do you think happens, regardless of the decision that is rendered in a couple of weeks in this case? Is this just the first of many cases and trials that we may be looking at?
Well, I think there's certainly going to be a lot of trials, or maybe they'll group them together on the fraud, because he defrauded, yes, the settlement that went to his housekeeper after she died following a fall on the steps at Moselle, the family hunting estate. He has admitted that he took that money, and that was in the millions. He's also been accused of defrauding clients going back 10, 15 years, stealing their settlements, stealing from their settlements. So I think all that will come to trial. And then, yeah, as you say, there are these two other deaths. There's Gloria Satterfield herself. There's whose death was, I think, ruled an accident at the time. And they SLED have announced at some point that they were reopening that case. They got permission to exhume her body. I don't think they've actually done it. And there are sort of whispers and rumors that maybe it wasn't so accidental. That there are all kinds of rumors around her death. It's unclear where that's going to go. The other death of Stephen Smith in 2015, who was a 19-year-old nursing student who was killed on the road, found dead on the road at night near, not far from Hampton. It was looked like a hit and run, but the South Carolina Highway Patrol, who were first investigated, said in fact it had none of the usual evidence of a hit and run, and they were looking at it as a deliberate killing, as a murder, and they began investigating it as that. And they got leads that were connecting it fairly early on. There were stories that reaching them that the murder boys were involved, Paul and his brother Buster, and they pursued those leads a certain distance, trying to track down the rumors. And they got, I think they got as far as Buster's closest friend, and then they dropped it. Or they were taken off because the town pathologist ruled it an accidental death. And so no Murdochs were ever questioned about it. That doesn't necessarily mean they were involved, but it shows you the both of those cases show you the kind of respect that the family was held in, that the police were just not kind of pushing at them in any way. They weren't questioning them in the Stephen Smith case, and they didn't question them in the Satterfield case. They took Alex's version of the story as gospel, and that was the end of the matter. Now they're re-looking at them, so we'll see.
We have just a less than a minute left. I want to ask each of you, having done the work that you've done, do you think you're likely to re-examine once there's a verdict in the case or further developments occur? I'll start with you, James.
I don't know. I'm following the story. I don't know whether I'll write any more about it. And I'm following the trial. I hadn't thought I would, but it's just too interesting. And
Bill?
Yeah, well, I will be following Jocelyn, who was on earlier. I will be following her up for updates. The Post and Courier has been putting up nice little short updates every afternoon. So I'll be watching closely, and we'll see where it takes us.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate both James Lasden, Bill Chappell, also Jocelyn Grushik. I am Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening to our show about the Murdoch trial. Much more to say about this in the weeks ahead. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.